Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
A Florida shooting death last month triggers another debate over the state's controversial Stand Your Ground law.
He killed an unarmed black man who was standing up for his family. Lock him up or give up your badge.
Also this week, converting algae into Adidas. Could new technology be the solution to the toxic blooms now plaguing so much of Florida's waterways and beaches?
6 months, a few years, and we can reduce enough of the nutrients to restore the lake back to its healthier state.
Speaking of green stuff, we'll also look at the seemingly endless uncertainties regarding Florida's medical marijuana law and hear from the head of the U.S. Veterans Administration and his plans to repair the beleaguered agency. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. A dispute over a parking space turned deadly last month, triggering a new debate over Florida's already controversial Stand Your Ground law. Sasha Cordner takes a look at how that debate further accelerated this week, even impacting the state's gubernatorial contest.
Since Marquise McLaughlin's death last month, his girlfriend, Brittany Jacobs, says her family hasn't been the same.
It's really hard because at the end of the day, my kids are still asking me questions. Where is, you know, their father? And, you know, I got to keep strong for them and, you know, just tell them that daddy is resting right now.
Oh, man.
But it's hard.
McLaughlin, a black man, was shot by Michael Draca, a white man, during a dispute over parking in a handicapped spot. While McLaughlin was inside a Clearwater convenience store, Jacobs was illegally parked in that handicapped spot with her kids. It was then Draca confronted her about parking there without a permit. The security video shows McLaughlin coming out of the convenience store and pushing Draca to the ground. That's when Draca fired his shots.
I'm still going to stand up and I'm still going to fight for what is right. And that's my man was right. Marquise was right.
Amen.
He was just protecting us.
Yeah.
He was a good man, a good father, and he didn't do nothing wrong but just try to protect us.
Draca claimed he fired in self-defense, and Pinellas County Sheriff Bob Gualtieri decided not to arrest him, citing Florida's Stand Your Ground law. But Jacobs' attorney, Ben Crump, says had the roles been reversed, there would have been a different outcome.
Can you imagine if it was a white woman sitting in her car with her two little children? And a black man like Marquise McLaughlin came up to that car, some stranger, yelling, screaming, and cursing at that white mother. And the white father came out to defend his family. And the black strange man shot the white father. Does anybody believe the police would not have arrested him on the spot?
Since the shooting, there have been protests and rallies across the state that has led to a revived discussion over whether to appeal Florida's Stand Your Ground law. Tensions rose recently when Reverend Al Sharpton, during a Clearwater rally, called for Sheriff Gualtieri to arrest Draca or step down.
He killed an unarmed black man who was standing up for his family. Lock him up or give up your badge.
To which Gualtieri later replied,
"You know, it's a bunch of rhetoric, so I'm not, you know, I didn't pay much attention to it, to tell you the truth. I wasn't there and don't really care what Al Sharpton has to say. You know, go back to New York, mind your own business."
Supporters of the McLaughlin family and their attorney Crump have said the video speaks for itself. But Gualtieri disagrees, saying facts matter and there were, quote, obscure camera angles. As for not making the arrest, he adds he was just following the self-defense law that allows people to use deadly force if they feel threatened without the duty to retreat. But he adds Draca could still face charges.
The final charging decision will be made by the state attorney, as the law says it should in this situation. I've said from day one that this case will be referred to the state attorney's office. I've never said the investigation is complete or over, and in fact, I've said the contrary. As far as my decision not to arrest Draca, my decision is based on the requirements of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. It is a preliminary decision about arrest and not a final decision about charges.
Meanwhile, debate over Gualtieri's decision has spilled over into this year's election, including the Florida governor's race. All the Democratic gubernatorial candidates have called for the repeal of Florida's Stand Your Ground law. That includes billionaire Jeff Green, who spoke recently on MSNBC.
And we should all in Florida be ashamed of ourselves for allowing this continue to be on the books. And why this sheriff has not arrested this murderer is completely beyond me.
Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum was also among a group of civil rights leaders and politicians who marched recently to the Capitol to speak with Governor Rick Scott, who was in Columbia at the time. Gillum participated in a brief sit-in until they spoke to a governor staffer. Calling this an emergency, Gillum said Governor Scott had the power to issue an executive order to put a halt to the law.
There is confusion, and this is the kind of confusion that we can't tolerate. This kind of confusion can result in the loss of innocent life. Now, they've issued executive orders to declare that beaches are all public.
Yeah.
They've issued executive orders to declare that we ought to extend voting hours so that people can vote, rightly so. We call on them again to issue an executive order to protect all life.
Republican gubernatorial candidates have also weighed in. During the final GOP debate, Florida Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam sided with the sheriff.
I'm proud to have worked with the law enforcement officials who have endorsed me and are supporting my campaign. And I stand with them when the Democrats are holding a sit-in and flying in Reverend Al Sharpton to protest our support of the Second Amendment here in Florida. I supported the sheriff in that instance. My opponent did not. I will protect your right to defend yourself, to defend your family, to defend your business, to raise your children, to safely and responsibly hunt and shoot and collect firearms.
And Republican opponent Florida Congressman Ron DeSantis said while he's against a repeal of the self-defense law, he believes Stand Your Ground did not apply in this case.
Democrats like Gillum and Green, they would impose upon Floridians a duty to retreat when they are being attacked. I think that that's totally unacceptable. I think that that puts the scales in favor of the criminal element. I believe that we have a right to stand our ground. I think it's a good law, but I also think it should be applied with an objective standard. And I've been joined by a lot of people in the state legislature on the Republican side who wrote that. So we will defend the Stand Your Ground law 100%, but I don't want some of these instances that really don't involve that to be put in and end up being fodder for criticism. It's an important law, and it's a way to protect our freedoms.
Meanwhile, Friday at noon marked the deadline for lawmakers to decide whether to trigger a special session to repeal or amend Florida's Stand Your Ground law. It required 3/5 majority in the Republican-controlled legislature. But that Democratic effort had already failed by Thursday night. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Florida's problem with algal blooms has taken center stage, and efforts to mitigate it are in high demand. A partnership between an engineering firm and bioplastics company aims to bring a new type of solution to the market. Ryan Daly reports one Florida county is already trying it out.
Lee County isn't the only in Florida or even in the U.S. with an algal bloom problem.
What we've seen now is an ongoing red tide bloom. Now all these nutrients that are coming from the water, from Lake Okeechobee, these cyanobacteria blooms, You know, from the on-the-ground perspective, it appears to be compounding and making it significantly worse. So it's, you know, what we're seeing is collapse. And what we need is solutions, you know, long-term solutions that'll, you know, allow this estuary an opportunity to recover.
That's Captains for Clean Water co-founder Daniel Andrews telling WGCU's Julie Glynn about the situation locally. Lee County is one of the first to use a system of algae removal developed by a global engineering firm, AECOM, recently named by Bloomberg as the world's largest. With about $700,000 in funding from the state's Department of Environmental Protection, the county is contracting with AECOM. Dan Levy, the firm's vice president, says the technology has been in the works for some time.
A lot of effort has been put forward on the academia side, on research and studying it. What we're trying to do now is bringing it to the field. And that led us to the development of these semi-permanent systems that could be put into these areas that have nutrient-impacted lakes, eutrophic lakes, where we have an excessive amount of nutrients, to go in there and do something that we consider to be short time, meaning 6 months, a few years, and we can reduce enough of the nutrients to restore the lake back to its healthier state.
AECOM has already done work in North Fort Myers and in Cape Coral's Nautilus Canal. As Levy explains, the process removes the rich element of algae cells from what's called the phototrophic zone. It's a nearly 1 foot layer below the water table.
As we pull the water out from this phototrophic zone, it's going to go into a containment system that has micro bubbles on the bottom. So as the water is being there, we're going to be adding a polymer to it that'll allow it to bind up the algae cells, and this micro bubble system on the bottom will create essentially a lift to allow this now formed particles to float up to the top.
And that, according to Levy, is when the algae can be removed.
We're then able to essentially skim off that top layer, and the remaining water then is filtered and returned back.
The recovered algae biomass is put into a storage unit. But then the question facing Levy and others is what to do with the algae once it's extracted. For that, he turned to a company called Bloom, which has been turning algae into biofoam for use in products like shoes and surfboard mats. Ryan Hunt is Bloom's chief technology officer.
I co-founded Algix, which is the parent company of Bloom, in 2010. And that was spun off out of research I was doing at the University of Georgia. And so our goal was using algae to treat wastewater and absorb nitrates and phosphates from the water and CO2 from the air, or CO2 dissolved in the water, and convert that those pollutants, those nutrients, into something of value.
It was something of an accident, Hunt says, that he discovered algae can be converted to biofoam.
First started doing this, I was actually making small little samples that were 100% blue-green algae, like spirulina, and was compressing them, applying heat, and making little compressed bars, and those bars were essentially exhibited some thermoplastic-like properties.
Levy says that conversion process has additional environmental advantages.
If we just look at biofoams, at foam product and the footwear industry, they use a lot of petrochemicals. So every time, and everybody that wears sneakers has a foam product, that is made with petrochemicals. So part of our plan and part of our vision is to say, let's reduce the petrochemicals. And we found, and Bloom really has pioneered that, the ability to reduce the amount of petrochemicals in foam by substituting it with algae.
And the resulting biofoam does not have the toxic properties that some algae species carry, according to Hunt.
Detectable levels of microcystin are far below even the organ limit for eating algae, actually, for eating it. So theoretically, if you wanted to, you could actually eat the shoe and still be in compliance with the organ law. But I don't recommend doing that.
A spokesman for Lee County says it is currently working on the best way to quantify the project's results. Because algae mitigation efforts in Lee County are being expedited due to severity, the algae harvested from those waterways will not be given to Bloom to convert to biofoam. But the companies plan to work together on future projects. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
The head of the Florida Department of Children and Families is leaving. Governor Rick Scott announcing late this afternoon that Secretary Mike Carroll is leaving the agency effective September 6th. Carroll has served at DCF and its predecessor, the Department of Health and Rehabilitative Services, since January of 1990. He's the longest-serving DCF secretary in the department's history, holding the agency's top slot since 2014. No reason for the resignation was given, and the governor's office said more details on future department leadership would be announced soon. Still to come on Capitol Report, a judge says Florida cannot limit the number of medical marijuana treatment centers.
You know, there's still a lot of municipalities throughout the state that have just enacted complete bans on medical marijuana dispensaries within their locations.
And the head of the U.S. Veterans Administration comes to Florida and promises his agency is racing to correct a multitude of problems that have been delaying or even denying much-needed services to vets.
If America's doctors, nurses, and small-town emergency rooms are going to help our veterans, we need to help them.
Several legal actions happened last week involving medical marijuana in Florida. One ruling found that the state can't limit the number of medical marijuana treatment centers, known as MMTCs. In other words, no caps on the number of dispensaries. Another involves an appeal over whether medical marijuana can be smoked. A judge ruled that patients should be able to smoke the drug, and the state is appealing that decision. Attorney John Lockwood of the Lockwood Law Firm in Tallahassee represents medical marijuana operators and would-be operators. He sat down with Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan.
We have a ruling that says the state cannot limit the number of medical marijuana providers, centers. Correct. Tell us about that.
This order was in response to a challenge. And the challenge basically said that under Amendment 2 that was passed in 2016 in Florida, that the state had no authority to, one, limit the number of medical marijuana treatment centers, and two, they could not require that these treatment centers be what's called vertically integrated. And in Florida, what that means is that the MMTC must cultivate, process, and dispense its own medical marijuana. It cannot simply be a dispensary or just a processor or just a cultivator.
So what was the limit? There's the 2014 law,
correct,
there's the constitutional amendment. So what kind of limit are we talking about the state putting in place?
So we've had a number of iterations of this. Initially, it was just going to be 5 licenses in the state. There was some litigation in response to that. And then there was a 6th and a 7th and an 8th license that got awarded. Currently, we're at 14 licenses in the state. The state has approximately 7 more licenses that they should be issuing within, I would say, could be within the next 6 months. And then we have patient thresholds. Every 100,000 patients that come online in the state of Florida that are what's called active qualified patients. Each 100,000 patients, the state would issue an additional 4 licenses within 6 months of that. So theoretically, we could be at a scenario where we're at, you know, 26, 27, 28 licenses, you know, maybe slightly more than that once the market is, you know, fully matured.
Where do we stand with edibles right now?
So the way the statute was written, edibles are authorized, but it's contingent on the Department of Health enacting a regulation for the MMTCs to follow. At this point, the department has not followed up with a proposed rule.
The Office of Compassionate Use, now the Office of Medical Marijuana Use, is being sued a lot.
That's correct.
What are the biggest issues?
Obviously, this lawsuit that would potentially eliminate the caps could have dramatic impacts on the industry. I would say followed behind that, one that is probably near and dear to a lot of patients' heart is whether or not they can purchase smokable marijuana. So that case is ongoing right now. And I think a lot of these lawsuits are probably going to drag on for a couple of years as they work their way through the appellate process. I think it's probably fair to say that any emerging industry is going to have its bumps in the road. There's going to be a lot of lawsuits. It's natural to see this. This is nothing that really surprises me.
And I hear about all these lawsuits, and I think at what cost? how much is this really going to cost the taxpayers?
The state's going to spend millions of dollars defending these cases. It's a very costly process, especially when you talk about circuit court litigation, then you have appellate court litigation, and then dealing with the constitutionality of statutes, you're ultimately going to end up before the Florida Supreme Court, and those are very specialized proceedings, and so it's going to be a very costly process.
Yeah. What do your medical marijuana growing clients want from the state?
Probably one of the biggest hurdles that we've had has been dealing with local governments and some of the zoning restrictions. You know, there's still a lot of municipalities throughout the state that have just enacted complete bans on medical marijuana dispensaries within their locations. And so there's a lot of places in South Florida that you still can't have a medical marijuana dispensary in.
Will the state have the final say in that, or can local communities do that?
So the state passed a law that gave the communities the option to either enact an outright ban, or they could authorize medical marijuana dispensaries, provided that their regulations are no more stringent than what's applicable for pharmacies. And so there are some local governments that said, you know what, we'll just take option A and just ban it all. You know, when you're looking at the city of Miami and places like that, there's a lot of patient population there in those areas, and to not be able to have a medical marijuana dispensary in there is making it rather difficult to get to patients.
Particularly in South Florida, do you think that this could be a response to the pill mill issue? Are communities skittish down there?
Well, if it is, they shouldn't be. There's a lot of states right now, and it's interesting you bring it up, that are starting to look at medical marijuana as a alternative to the opioid crisis. And there's quite a bit of information out there about states that have opened up their medical marijuana laws, and you know, for medicinal and recreational programs, are seeing the number of opioid type prescriptions and all have plummeted.
Attorney John Lockwood, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan talking with Tallahassee attorney John Lockwood. Florida voters have the right to decide whether all local constitutional officers, including sheriffs and tax collectors, should be elected. That, according to a ruling made by a Leon County judge this week. Circuit Judge James Shelfer rejected a challenge from Volusia and Broward counties that sought to have what's known as Amendment 10 removed from the November 6 general election ballot. The challenge argued the ballot language and summary were misleading. The amendment, which was placed on the ballot by the Constitution Revision Commission, would make the five constitutional offices, sheriff, tax collector, supervisor of elections, clerk of the court, and property appraiser, mandatory and would require elections for the offices in all 67 counties. It would also prohibit charter counties from abolishing or modifying those offices. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, Florida is not only the third largest state in terms of overall population, it also ranks number 3 nationally when it comes to its population of military veterans, around 1.5 million. That's behind only California and Texas. There are 20 clinics and hospitals operated by the U.S. Veterans Administration across the state to help provide health care services for veterans. One such clinic is in Florida's capital city. The newly confirmed Secretary of the Veterans Administration, Robert Wilkie, was there on August 8th for a ceremony to rename it after Ernest Boots Thomas of Monticello, Florida. He was among the troops depicted in the famous Raising the Flag over Iwo Jima statue in Washington, D.C. That's also where, as Wilkie notes, about the only thing members of Congress can get together to support are those who served in the military.
I mean, I just spoke at a ceremony where I was bracketed by the senior Democratic senator from the state, Bill Nelson, Al Lawson, the Democratic congressman from Jacksonville to Tallahassee area, and Dr. Neil Dunn, who represents the western part of the Panhandle. There really isn't a lot of contention when it comes to this issue.
all is certainly not rainbows and unicorns, Wilkie admits. One big problem is that too many veterans can't automatically access the health care services provided by VA hospitals and clinics. Stories abound of paperwork snafus that can deny vets care for months or even years. One such vet is Sky Musson. She's now a law student and vice president of the Collegiate Veterans Association at Florida State University. But when she mustered out of the service a few years back, Musson says as a disabled vet, she needed access to VA health care right away. And in her case, that was not immediately forthcoming.
Personally, I did everything that I was appropriate. I was supposed to be one of those people who submitted their paperwork 90 days before I got out, and it was immediately in the system. And it still took almost 12 months past my retirement date to be in the system.
Wilkie says problems like Musson's are being addressed.
We are in the process of beginning a massive automation of VA systems. I said that once a veteran gets into our system, gets into the facility, 9 times out of 10, he's happy.
There's another issue, Wilkie acknowledges. A significant number of vets actually receive the bulk of their health care from providers other than VA facilities.
You know, Omar Bradley ran VA right after World War II, and about 30% of veterans' care was out in the community. And that number really hasn't changed much. But what that means is that if America's doctors, nurses, and small-town emergency rooms are going to help our veterans, we need to help them.
In the past, that help hasn't always been immediately forthcoming. More than a few private health care providers no longer accept VA patients because of reimbursement delays. Wilkie says one option that may help is to give vets access to the care available to active military personnel.
In areas of Florida where there are active military bases, to exchange the talent and the resources of the Department of Defense with VA to give that veteran more choice.
Wilkie says all of these changes and improvements will take considerable work. He also acknowledges there are personnel issues that still need attention, but he does not consider these insurmountable.
I do want to remind Americans that of the 370,000 employees of VA, there may be 1,000 really bad eggs, and that shouldn't take away from the 369,000 who are doing their duty every day. So that's a story I think we need to hear.
A story that's of particular interest to the 1.5 million military veterans who call Florida home. Regular Capital Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FBR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the State Capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org. And from Rambana and Ritchie, immigration attorneys concentrating on complex immigration across the nation from Florida's capital and their mobile office. Self-sponsored green cards, I-9 compliance, and deportation defense. Rambana and Ritchie, on the web at rambana.com. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.